Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source grassroots community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. It's useful to get some notebook, paper, and pen to take notes during the show. What we have been doing for some months now is exploring the myths about money. Our money system is not what we have been led to believe. The creation of money has been privatized or taken over by a private money cartel. Except for coins, all of our money is now created as loans advanced by private banking institutions, including the private Federal Reserve. Banks create the principal, but not the interest, to service their loans. To find the interest, new loans must continually be taken out, expanding the money supply, inflating prices, and robbing you of the value of your money. We've been specifically looking at a book called The Web of Debt, which unravels the deception and presents a clear picture of the financial abyss towards which we are heading. It then explores workable alternatives, particularly one that was tested in colonial America and is grounded in the best of American economic thought, including the writings of Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, and Abraham Lincoln. It helps us to analyze and improve our own financial security, personally and nationally, and to deeply understand the cause of the problems we are personally experiencing financially. At the onset, I give an important credit because the thoughts, ideas, and examples used in this program are directly from or based on the work, theories, and books of attorney, scholar, and author Ellen Brown, who has 11 books and scores of articles on debt-related matters. I highly recommend her book, The Web of Debt. You should also visit her website by the same name. You could also go to www.kruufm.com under Archives to listen to all of the shows produced on this and other debt-related topics. This particular series is under Life and Debt Web. At the end of the last show, I discussed the secret bankruptcy of the banks, which is really a meltdown. The debt bubble was showing clear signs of imploding, and when it did, it was likely to liquidate the private banking empire that had been built on it. To prevent that financial meltdown, the witches of Wall Street and their European affiliates had resorted to desperate measures, including a giant derivatives bubble that was jeopardizing the whole shaky system. In February of 2004, in an article called The Coming Storm, the London Economist warned that top banks around the world were massively exposed to high-risk derivatives and that there was a very real risk of an industry-wide meltdown. The situation was compared to that before the 1998 collapse of the long-term capital management company, when bets went spectacularly wrong after Russia defaulted. Financial markets went berserk, and LTCM, a very large hedge fund, had to be rescued by its bankers at the behest of the Federal Reserve. John Hoffel wrote in 2002 that the Fed had been quietly rescuing banks ever since. He contended that the banking system actually went bankrupt in the late 1980s when the collapse of the junk bond market and the real estate bubble of that decade. With the collapse of the junk bond market and the real estate bubble of that decade, The savings and loan sector collapsed, along with nearly every large Texas bank, and that was just the tip of the iceberg. Quote, Citicorp was secretly taken over by the Federal Reserve in 1989. Shotgun mergers were arranged for other giant banks. Backdoor bailouts were given through the Fed's lending mechanism, and bank examiners were ordered to ignore bad loans. These measures, coupled with a headlong rush into derivatives and other forms of speculation, gave the banks a veneer of solvency while actually destroying what was left of the U.S. banking system. End quote. The banks were in trouble, and that's the big banks, because of big gambles that had not paid off. Third world loans that had gone into default, giant corporations that had gone bankrupt, massive derivative bets gone wrong. Like with the bankrupt giant Enron, profound economic weakness was masked by phony accounting that created a veneer of solvency. Hoffel wrote, quote, the U.S. banks, especially the derivatives giants, are masters at this game, counting trillions of dollars of worthless IOUs, derivatives, overblown assets, and unpayable debts on their books at face value in order to appear solvent. In the late 1980s, the term zombie was used to refer to banks which manifested some mechanical signs of life but were in fact dead. Close quote. Between 1984 and 2002, bank failures were accompanied by a wave of consolidations and takeovers that reduced the number of banks by 45%. The top seven banks were consolidated into three, Citigroup, J.P. Morgan Chase, and Bank of America. Hoffel wrote, quote, the result of all these mergers is a group of much larger and far more bankrupt giant banks. A similar process has played out worldwide. The global list also includes two institutions which specialize in pumping up the U.S. real estate bubble. Both Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac specialize in converting mortgages into mortgage-backed securities and will vaporize when the U.S. housing bubble pops. Close quote. The zombies, said Hoffel, have taken over the asylum. In 2002, Bank One was rumored to be a buyer for the zombie giant J.P. Morgan Chase. Actually, the merger took place in 2004. It was ludicrous, Hoffel wrote, since on paper J.P. Morgan Chase had twice the assets of Bank One. Still letting Morgan fail, which it seemed determined to do, is clearly unacceptable from the standpoint of the White House Federal Reserve Plunge Protection Team. In February 2004, in an article titled Cooking the Books, U.S. Banks are Giant Casinos, Michael Edward concurred. He wrote that U.S. banks were engaging in smoke and mirror accounting, in which they were merging with each other in order to hide their derivative losses with paper asset bookkeeping. Quote, the public is being conned into thinking that U.S. banks are still solvent because they show gains in their stock paper value. If the U.S. markets were not manipulated, U.S. banks would collapse overnight along with the entire U.S. economy. Astronomical losses for U.S. banks, as well as most banks, have been concealed with mispriced derivatives. The problem with this is that these losses don't have to be reported to shareholders, so in all truth and reality, many U.S. banks are already insolvent. What that means is that U.S. banks have become nothing less than a Ponzi scheme paying account holders with other account holder assets or deposits. Robbing Peter to pay Paul has never worked, and every Ponzi scheme, illegal pyramid scam, has always ended abruptly with great losses for every person who invested in them. U.S. bank account holders are about to find this out. Close quote. If you are just tuning in, this is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. So all of this has raised the question, has private commercial banking become obsolete? According to the commentators, the epidemic of bank insolvencies is not just the result of individual mismanagement and overreaching, but marks the inevitable end time of a Ponzi scheme that is inherently unsustainable. When the dollar was on the gold standard, banks had to deal with periodic bank runs because they did not have sufficient gold to cover their transactions. The Federal Reserve was instituted early in the 20th century to provide backup money to prevent such runs. That effort was followed 20 years later by the worst depression in modern history. The gold standard was then abandoned, allowing larger and larger debt bubbles to flood the system, resulting in the derivative and housing crises looming today. When those bubbles pop, the only option may be another change in the rules of the game, a Copernican shift of the sort envisioned by Professor Liu, which I've talked about in the past. Robert Gutman, professor of economics at Hofstra University in New York, is another academician who feels the current banking system may have outlived its usefulness. In a 1994 text called How Credit Money Shapes the Economy, he states, it may well be that banks as currently constituted are in the process of becoming obsolete. Increasingly, their traditional functions can be carried out more efficiently by other institutions. He went on, quote, American banks have been hit over the last two decades by a variety of adverse developments. Their traditional functions, taking deposits and making loans, have been subjected to increasing competition from less regulated institutions. In the face of such market erosion on both sides of their balance sheet ledger, the banks have had to find new opportunities. Even though most commercial banks have managed to survive the surge in bad debt losses, they still face major competitive threats from less regulated institutions. It is doubtful whether they can stop the market inroads made by pension funds, mutual funds, investment banks, and other institutions that benefit from the marketization of our financial system. The revolution in computer and communications technologies has enabled others to access and process data at low cost. Neither lenders nor borrowers need banks anymore. Both sides may find it increasingly more appealing to deal directly with each other. Close quote. At the time of that quote, hundreds of banks had failed after writing off large chunks of non-performing loans to developing countries, farmers, oil drillers, real estate developers, and takeover artists. Commercial banks and thrifts facing growing bad debt losses were forced to liquidate assets and tighten credit terms, producing a credit crunch that choked off growth. The banks were also facing growing competition from investment pools such as pension funds and mutual funds. The banks responded with a dramatic shift away from loans, their core business, to liquidate bundles of claims sold as securities. The commercial banking business was also eroding as corporations switched from loans to securities for funding. FDIC insurance, which was originally intended to protect individual savers against loss, took on the quite different function of bailing out failing institutions. Such a shift in focus led directly to adoption of the FDIC's too-big-to-fail policy of 1984. Gutman wrote, "The result has been increasingly costly government intervention, which now has bankrupted the system." As banks lost profits in the competitive commercial lending business, they had to expand into investment banking to remain profitable. The expansion was facilitated in 1999 when the Glass-Steagall Act, which forbade commercial and investment banking in the same institution, was repealed. Investment banking includes corporate fundraising, mergers and acquisitions, brokering trades, and trading for the bank's own account. Despite this merger of banking functions, however, profits continued to falter. According to a 2002 publication called Growing Profits Under Pressure by the Boston Consulting Group, quote, "As the effects of the economic downturn continue to erode corporate profits, large commercial banks, both global and regional, face growing pressures on their corporate and investment banking businesses. From the outside, commercial banks confront increasing competition, particularly from global investment banks that are competing more vigorously for commercial banks' traditional corporate transactions. In addition, commercial banks are finding that their corporate clients are increasingly becoming their rivals. Companies today meet more of their own banking needs themselves. In recent years, many commercial banks have acquired investment banks, hoping to gain access to new clients. But investment banking revenues have suffered with the decline in mergers and acquisitions, equity capital markets, and trading activities. All too often, costs have continued to rise. Close quote. An article in the June 2006 Economist reported that even with the success of bank trading departments, the overall share values of investment banks were falling. Evidently, this was because investors suspected that the bank's returns had been souped up by trading with borrowed money, and they feared the risks involved. Meanwhile, banking as a public service was being lost to the all-consuming quest for profits. Investment banks make most of their profits from trading for their own accounts rather than from servicing customers, as we discussed before. According to William Hummel in Money, What It Is, How It Works, the 10 largest U.S. banks hold almost half the country's total banking assets. These banks, called money market banks or money center banks, include Citibank, J.P. Morgan Chase, and Bank of America. They are large conglomerates that combine commercial banking with investment banking. However, very little of their business is what we normally think of as banking, taking deposits, providing checking services, and making consumer or small business loans. Rather, says Hummel, they mainly engage in four activities. 1. Portfolio business, which is asset accumulation and funding for their own accounts, something they do by borrowing money cheaply and selling the acquired assets at a premium. 2. Corporate finance, corporate lending and public offerings. 3. Distribution, the sale of the bank's own securities, including treasuries, municipal securities, and euro CDs. And 4. Trading, largely market making. Recall that market makers are the players chiefly engaged in naked short selling, an inherently fraudulent practice. Patrick Byrne, who has been instrumental in exposing the naked shorting scandal, states that as much as 75% of the profits of big investment banks may come from their role as prime brokers, something he says is a fancy word for the stock loan business or renting the same stock several times over. Stocks are rented for the purpose of selling them short. According to an article in Forbes, prime brokerage is the business of catering to hedge funds, particularly lending securities to funds so they can execute their trading strategies. We've seen that hedge funds are groups of investors colluding to acquire companies and bleed them of their assets, speculate in derivatives, manipulate markets, and otherwise make profits for themselves at the expense of workers and small investors. If you are just tuning in, this is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. The big money center banks facilitating these dubious practices are also the banks that must periodically be bailed out by the Fed and the government because they are supposedly too big to fail. Yet these banks have little to do with what we normally think of as banking services. They are too big to fail only because they are responsible for a great Ponzi scheme that has the entire economy in its death grip. They have created a perilous derivatives bubble that has generated billions of dollars in short-term profits but has destroyed the financial system in the process. Collusion among mega banks has made derivative trading less risky, but this has not served the larger community, but rather has hurt small investors and the fledgling corporations targeted by vulture capitalism. The flea's gain has been the dog's loss. In a March 2007 article called "It Too Big to Bail Out," Dave Lewis observed that the next major bank bailout could exceed the capacity of the taxpayers to keep the private banking boat afloat. Lewis said he was a veteran Wall Street trader who remembered the 1980s when banks actually could fail. The too big to fail concept came in at the end of the 1980s when the savings and loans collapsed and Citibank lost 50% of its share price. In 1989, Congress passed the Financial Institutions Reform, Recovery, and Enforcement Act, which bailed out the SNLs with taxpayer money. Citibank's share price also recouped its losses. Then in 1991, a Wall Street investment bank called Salomon Brothers threatened bankruptcy after it was caught submitting false bids for the U.S. Treasury securities, and the New York Fed chief announced that the bank would no longer be able to participate in Treasury auctions. Warren Buffett, whose company owned 12% of the stock of Salomon Brothers, negotiated heavily with Treasury Secretary Nicholas Brady, and Salomon Brothers was saved. After that, says Lewis, too big to fail became standard policy. Quote, "It is now 16 years later. The thin edge of the wedge has done its thing, and the circuit is now complete. The financial industry has been, in a sense, nationalized. Credit rating agencies will now simply assume the government support for large financial institutions. But there are limits to the amount of support even the mighty U.S. taxpayer can provide. If the derivatives-inspired collapse of LTCM was a problem, how much more problematic would be a similarly inspired derivatives collapse at J.P. Morgan, given their U.S. $62.6 trillion in exposure? According to the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, this $62.6 trillion in derivatives exposure is funded by assets of only $1.2 trillion. And who will fill in the gap? U.S. taxpayers? Are we now willing to upend social harmony, or what little that remains, by breaking promises of Social Security and other entitlements in order to keep big banks that mismanage their investment portfolios afloat? And all this, by the way, while the upper class has been enjoying its biggest tax breaks in decades? The $150 billion bailout of the SNLs in the late 80s caused a recession and cost George Bush the Elder a second term. I wonder what effects a $1 trillion or even $5 trillion bailout would cause. Short of a military dictatorship, I can't imagine a bailout of that size for that reason passing through Congress. What if the problem arises due to a collapse of some intervention scheme? Will U.S. taxpayers be expected to bail out a covert scheme to keep the price of gold down or oil? More to the point, could U.S. taxpayers bail out such schemes? In the event support was needed and could be obtained under these conditions, why would anyone want to buy U.S. bonds? Close quote. If the financial industry has been nationalized, and if we, the taxpayers, are footing the bill, we can and should demand a banking system that serves the taxpayers' interests rather than working at cross purposes with them. Only a few banks are considered too big to fail, entitling them to taxpayer bailout, but in some sense, all banks operating on the fractional reserve system are teetering on bankruptcy. Recall the definition of the term being unable to pay one's debts, being insolvent, having liabilities in excess of a reasonable market value of assets held. In an article called Fractional Reserve Banking, Murray Rothbard put the problem like this. Quote, depositors think of their checking account as equivalent to a warehouse receipt. If they put a chair in a warehouse before going on a trip, they expect to get the chair back whenever they present the receipt. Unfortunately, while banks depend on the warehouse analogy, the depositors are systematically diluted. Their money isn't there. An honest warehouse makes sure that the goods entrusted to its care are there, in its storeroom or vault. But banks operate very differently. Banks make money by literally creating money out of thin air, nowadays exclusively deposits rather than banknotes. This sort of swindling or counterfeiting is dignified by the term fractional reserve banking, which means that bank deposits are backed by only a small fraction of the cash they promise to have at hand and redeem, end quote. Before 1913, if too many of the bank's depositors came for their money at one time, the bank would have to come up short and would have to had close its doors. That was true until the Federal Reserve Act shored up the system by allowing troubled banks to borrow money from the Federal Reserve, which could create it on the spot by selling government securities to a select group of banks that created the money as bookkeeping entries on their books. By right, Rothbard said, the banks should be put into bankruptcy and the bankers should be jailed as embezzlers, just as they would have been before they succeeded in getting laws passed that protected their swindling. Instead, big banks are assured of being bailed out from their folly, encouraging them to take huge risks because they are confident of being rescued if things go amiss. This moral hazard has now been built into the decision-making process. But small businesses don't get bailed out when they make risky decisions that put them under the water. Why should big banks have that luxury? In a free market, big banks should be free to fail like any other business. It would be different if they actually were indispensable to the economy, as they claim. But these global mega banks spend most of their time and resources making profits for themselves at the expense of the small consumer, the small investor, and small countries. There are more efficient ways to get the banking services we need than by continually feeding and maintaining the parasitic banking machine we have now. It may be time to cut the mega banks loose from the Fed's apron strings and let them deal with the free market forces they purport to believe in. Without the collusion of the Plunge Protection Team, the CRMPG, and the Federal Reserve, some major banks could soon wind up in bankruptcy. The Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation deals with bankrupt banks by putting them into receivership, a form of bankruptcy in which a company can avoid liquidation by reorganizing with the help of a court-appointed trustee. When a bank is put into receivership, the trustee is the FDIC, an agency of the federal government. In return for bailing the bank out, the FDIC has the option of retaining the bank as a public asset. Why this might not be the disaster for the larger community that has been predicted and might even work out to the public benefit will be discussed later. But what we have to look at is what we can do to protect ourselves and our assets in the meantime. Like Auntie M, market bears warn to run for the cellar. They say to prepare for the coming storm by getting out of the U.S. stocks, the U.S. dollar, and excess residential real estate, and to invest instead in gold and silver, precious metal stocks, oil stocks, and foreign currencies. Many good books and financial newsletters are available on this subject. And we will continue in the next show. This is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous debt manageable life.